and then that group that got in has that much more reason to keep people who are out, out.
Well, but if we're talking cross-nationally, then...
I read Eric Tanzer's thought, and many other things, so, but I mean, I think the case of Sweden is a good case to discuss, because I mean, the answer would be, okay, well, the Swedish working class is living in a social democracy within a world which is like full of inequalities. So first question is if there is a causal mechanism, like you say, in which the Swedish workers are better off because there are these workers around the world. And the second one is actually if in moral terms, maybe like what kind of world we have that we can have these countries with social democracy. Another, while there are other countries, which I think it's for any strategy, and the book in general, like if you can have this better world in the developed countries in a world that is unequal. So I guess that was my...
Now, as I understood Todd's question, it was not, does a successful symbiotic strategy depend upon the existence of a labor aristocracy? So one argument could be it's only by virtue of imperialism that transfers surplus from third world workers to first world societies that first world workers can have symbiotic strategies. And so first world workers, developed country workers, are a labor aristocracy globally, not by virtue of symbiotic strategies, but by virtue of imperialism, which makes possible symbiotic strategies. That's one version. But I thought you were asking the other form of the possible labor aristocracy question. Does a successful symbiotic strategy that forms a positive class compromise create a aristocracy of labor? Does it create a set of privileged workers? Privileged by virtue of being on that part of the curve where they can be in that zone of sort of win-win relations with capital. That latter story doesn't imply that it's at the expense of any other group of workers. So it does imply that there would be a relatively better off segment of the global working class, but it doesn't imply that it's a relation of exploitation between them and other workers. It's just a inequality between them. Whereas the first version implies an actual exploitative relationship between the advantaged workers who can then, by virtue of their advantages, forge a symbiotic relation.
But I think...
Go ahead, Kathy.
I think one of the things that makes me think a lot is the only way to get that, the scenario where you're not exploiting other people is essentially to not be trading with any other nation. Because once you are trading with another nation, it's impossible to not be benefiting by the fact that you can buy stuff from another country for cheaper than you'd be able to produce it in your own country because it's produced under labor and other standards which don't exist in your country. So then that's a, like, and I just think that that is a, also conceptually, well, I mean, it's hard to, I think Albania is the only country in the world that's ever.
But that's still separate from whether this has any connection to the symbiotic strategy thing. So. There are good reasons to oppose global exploitation and to argue for global redistribution and to think about how we could accomplish that. That's perfectly legitimate. And there may also be good reasons to say the most progressive things that can happen within the developed world is to forge symbiotic strategies, or not. I mean, but that is a possibility. But it doesn't follow that there's a connection between these in the sense that one is enabled by virtue of the other.
I was asking, though, I mean, to put it historically, whether, you know, the existing prototypical symbiotic transformations like the Swedish welfare state or whatever, whether we think that those are only possible in a world in which you have low-wage workers elsewhere who don't have the same benefits, and that without those cheaply produced commodities, the welfare state would not be viable locally. the National Aid, precisely because there was an absence of that cheap supply of goods. Right? So in that case, I think it is sort of dependent on the existence of these kind of global inequalities.
But when you frame it that way, it may be dependent upon it, but it may not make things worse. It might, in fact, it could be only by virtue of unequal exchange and global inequalities that symbiotic strategies could work in Sweden. And yet, when they work, they create a political culture in Sweden which supports global equality more than would be the case if they didn't have symbiotic strategies.
Right, but I'm saying that there's no way, let's say there's two countries, there's Sweden and there's the Philippines, and that if the welfare state in Sweden depends on the existence of low-wage work in the Philippines, then there's no way to get the Philippines to where Sweden is. That to me is the fundamental problem, that there's...
If it's
only possible because there's low-wage work elsewhere, then there's no way to change. And so, yeah, sure, better for Swedish workers, but only because... But what's the implication of the criticism?
Is the implication of the criticism that we should dismantle the Swedish welfare state?
No, I mean, the implication is that it's not a long-term viable strategy of transformation because it's not viable essentially everywhere. That it being done in one place precludes it being done in another place. That doesn't mean that it's bad where it's done. It's a scalability issue.
The last thing you said didn't follow from the previous one. The last thing is a different argument. The last thing you said is that it taking place in one place precludes it occurring in others. The previous thing you said is that it can only take place in Sweden because of global imperialism, which creates unequal exchange. That's why it occurs in this part of the world, not the other. But not that it makes it harder to occur anywhere else. It's with respect to that problem, it's a consequence, but it's not itself a cause. It doesn't make struggles against imperialism harder. I want to get the argument clear. Is it the claim that we would be better able to overcome capitalism if we dismantle the Swedish welfare state?
No, I'm saying...
And if it's not, then the question is, what would enable us to dismantle imperialism?
My argument is that if all of the assumptions are true, which may not be true, so if it's in fact the case that the welfare state in our wealthy country is only possible because there's imported cheap commodities from abroad, and if that means that it is therefore not possible to create a welfare state in the cheap country, then in a normative sense, I think that as a strategy, this is not viable because it means that we cannot have a strategy which enables us to achieve a welfare state or whatever it is.
Even though there may be no alternative strategy that would accomplish that goal.
If there were no, well, yeah, I, that's why I'm not saying this isn't an argument against welfare states. This is a question about symbiotic strategies. If symbiotic strategies are the only strategies out there, then this is a fundamental problem.
Already.
Well, so what would be the mechanism that a welfare state in Sweden would prevent the creation of symbiotic transformation in the Philippines if these were the only two countries we were taking into consideration?
Well, I guess the argument is... Sorry.
Go ahead.
I mean, I guess the argument is that creating a welfare state in the Philippines would then have effects on the welfare state in Sweden, make it non-viable.
How? I don't understand
how. Because there aren't cheap imported commodities to sustain the lifestyle of... I mean, wages are not just about wages, it's about what you buy with the wages, right? So.
Yeah, but the prices of commodities aren't only determined by the wages of the people who produce them, they're determined by the proportion of wages across the total... price of wages as a proportion of total costs and how productive labor is. So if a symbiotic transformation makes workers more productive or upscales capital or in such a way that, you know, you have more... In the Philippines. if in the Philippines they produce, they get together, they form some symbiotic transformation that increases the productivity of labor, wages can increase and prices can decrease.
But then would the Philippines have an interest in being in that? I mean, I think that would inherently change the relationship between the Philippines and Sweden. I don't know.
Well, hopefully in a good way. They would become more like equals than I don't know, rivals on an international scale. But I don't see how a welfare state in Sweden would necessarily inhibit a welfare state in the Philippines. And I don't see how it would be done on the basis of Sweden depends on cheap imports from
the Philippines. Well, the argument would have to be something like this, but I don't think it's probably a sustainable argument. The argument would have to be something like this. You can't get a symbiotic positive class compromise anywhere unless you have cheap commodities. In some parts of the world, like Sweden, you can get cheap commodities because there are poor parts of the world. So Sweden can have this symbiotic strategy successfully, and the Philippines can't, because you can't have a symbiotic strategy under those conditions. Right? You can only have symbiotic strategies under Swedish conditions. But they depend upon the existence of unequal exchange.
Is that true?
I don't think that's a true fact about Sweden.
Historically, I don't know the Swedish case. I'm preparing SCCD prelims, so I might be biased towards dependency and.
Historically,
the only periods in which third world countries could develop a welfare state was when, like in the Second World War, when there were no manufactured products imported from the First War, and there was a market for agricultural products. So, I mean, I know what that leads the Swedish case, because I know, but yes, the third world country like Philippines, in which conditions it can develop a welfare state, it was in industrial substitution at that time, or exporting manufactured goods and other times. But there is some periods in history, I mean, it's not that, okay, well, let's just make labor more productive and we'll...
I don't see why a low level of development precludes being able to engage in symbiotic strategies. It doesn't have to be, you know, obviously the Philippines can't say, okay, tomorrow we're going to have Sweden's welfare state here. It's an incremental process, but I don't see why a low level of development would stop a country from engaging, or the labor movement in any country from engaging in symbiotic strategies.
Kathy?
My reaction to that one is I think the incremental win and loss of people from engaging in symbiotic strategies makes it harder. The top has way more to lose in order to give people who are less poor within that country any substantial gain when you don't have as much wealth. And I also think, and within the, if we go back to like Sweden, or I think like one of the interesting things is after NAFTA, a lot of unions in Canada became more restrictive about who could be members of their union, because they essentially still wanted to protect their members, and they couldn't protect a growing membership when they had increased competition. As in guaranteed jobs too, right? Because if there's no jobs, a union just, like if you're a union and all your businesses who you work for leave, then you can't, you can guarantee a minimum salary but not for that many people. So they became more strict about who they let in. And also the salaries of those people could go down or could not increase as much because you have higher access, greater access to cheaper goods. But it becomes people, it ends up sort of the structures try to close in on themselves as opposed to opening in and letting in new people and trying to spread that structure and that compromise across a larger group.
a symbiotic strategy is a strategy in which we harness together two seemingly incompatible elements. So it's not every redistributive policy or every welfare state action are not symbiotic. Some of them can be statist strategies of buying off the working class, but not ones which enhance social power at all. So symbiotic strategy is a subset of lefty reformism. Left reformism are any state policies which increase social equality would be a kind of leftist reformist. Some of those things are not symbiotic. They just provide benefits to people. They may be perfectly good. We might want to defend them in our national contexts. But they're not symbiotic in the sense that I'm talking, because they don't increase social power. And these are strategies for increasing the weight of social power in the social configuration of power relations that define an economic structure. So the whole idea of all of these strategies, whether it be ruptural or interstitial or symbiotic, is to somehow figure out, if you agree with the hybridization way of thinking about this, you know, about thinking about pathways to socialism, how do we increase the social power component of this configuration, the socialist element in the hybrid? The ruptural one says the only way to do it is with an abrupt shift. You can't do it gradually. We got to somehow break the back of the existing system so that we render social power the dominant element, within which there might then be subordinate niches of capitalism still. A revolution doesn't have to imply no capitalism. It just means capitalism constrained and contained either within the state, if it's a statist revolution, or within social power, if it's a socialist, as I've rethought it, revolution. So that's the ruptural view. The interstitial view says, if we want to increase social power, let's just get on with the business of doing it. You know, let's build our social power institutions. And eventually, through some unspecified, perhaps magical metamorphosis, you know, our way of life is so much better, damn it, and we can produce, the Wikipedia equivalents in all spheres of life, combinations of community-supported agriculture and co-ops and whatever, just by building these things as rivals, they will eventually take over the economy. That's the fantasy plan, perhaps, of an interstitial strategy. The symbiotic strategy says, look, we can collaborate under certain circumstances with dominant elites and classes. We can figure out ways in which it turns out that expanding social power actually solves problems for them. And the reason to look for those instances is, if you do that, you can actually institutionalize these things in a stable and sustainable way. Whereas if every time you increase social power, it's a threat and undermining the interests of elites, then whenever they have a chance, they're going to destroy it. They're not going to have any stake in maintaining an equilibrium with increased social power. That's the symbiotic logic. You worry about, is this going to help solve some problem that elites care about? You worry about that because if you can find ways of connecting increased social power with solutions to collective action problems for elites, if you can do that, if you can manage that, then you're going to create a more stable configuration. Now, I was interpreting Todd's question as meaning, well, maybe the only conditions in which you can even approach social change in that fashion are conditions which are morally suspect because they depend upon global imperialism. That was one version. The other version was, even if that isn't true, when these projects succeed, what they do is they create these kinds of privileged strata. And so they're undesirable because, to the extent that they succeed, they create global divisions or reinforce them in some way.
Yeah, I want to make we were talking about the Swedish welfare state. I'm sure you can have some symbiotic strategies in Philippines or in Argentina or everywhere. But, we were talking about getting to the level of welfare of Sweden. That's maybe the long-term goal of the strategy. That's more problematic. I don't know if it's the same, discussing some symbiotic strategies that would lead to some kind of Swedish welfare state.
Can I add to that?
Clarifying question.
Probably we have the same question. In the first two strategies, the objective was to have state and economic power subordinated to social power. In the symbiotic strategy, there is an increase of social power, but there is not necessarily the social power, economic and state power subordinated to social power. Is that right?
Well,
there is an increase. Like, for example, if workers decide to keep their jobs but not ask for a wage, they're not actually subordinating the state or the economy. They're basically just being good brothers and sisters to themselves.
No, but the symbiotic strategy is that they do so in a way that helps consolidate their associational power so that certain kinds of... Certain
but the question is subordination.
It's about increasing... In a capitalist society, state power and capitalist power are not subordinated to social power. That's why it's capitalism. So social power is a subordinate element in the hybrid, but it can be a small or a bigger subordinate element in the hybrid. We're wanting to expand the arenas within which social power actually plays a role and has some real effects. So it's a different kind of capitalism. To have a capitalism in which you have no social power whatsoever is a different kind of capitalism from one in which social power has lots of venues where it operates, so that capitalist power cannot unilaterally act. It has to act through its interactions and negotiations and compromises with social power, because social power in its various forms has been consolidated, it's robust, it's durable, it can't simply be swept aside.
But in the Swedish case, we cannot say that there was no social power at all.
No, like, that is,
it was a dynamic economy, and it was...
But social democracy consolidated and institutionalized and rendered a more stable part of the institutional equilibrium of Sweden socially empowered forms of decision-making and resource allocation and rule-setting. So that while it is still true it was a capitalist economy, I'm not saying that Sweden became socialist, it was less capitalistic than American capitalism. Social democracy had a lot to do with that. The role of unions in national bargaining over regulations of labor markets, over regulation of working conditions, over training programs, over all sorts of things. And the fact that that union strength had political effects, so it was, you know, it was social empowerment via state regulation of capital. All that I think meant that social power had a stronger presence within this configuration.
So, if you say that, you need to provide an explanation for why Sweden had one of the most set of free trade policies in the world at that time.
Because
It's an interesting point, but like you can say that,
right.
It seems to be contradicting itself. Sweden, on the one hand, has very generous social package, but on the other hand, it's more liberal economically than the United States.
Well, the usual argument for the small social democratic countries is that their strategy was to create high levels of equality internal to their and solidarity internal to their countries. But because they were small, if they wanted to have a full range of consumer goods for people, for workers and others, they had to import them. They couldn't. My favorite example is Iceland. I mean, if Iceland didn't have an open economy, everybody would just live on fish, because it's
But it's remote.
A country of a few million people cannot produce everything. They have to import. And therefore, they have to figure out how can we have an open economy and still be productive and efficient. And one solution is to have an open economy and have it be very repressive. Another is to have an open economy and have very high levels of solidarity and cooperation. And so they opted for the solidarity cooperation solution, which turns out to be a pretty stable equilibrium. Mm-hmm. But I do think it involves workers having much more power collectively.
But I guess maybe this gets back to Todd's question and about the whole subordination of power, is in the Swedish, is there like a limit to the amount of social power that can be acquired in such a state, as so that up until the point of subordination, you know, so that, because with the other strategies, I guess you could see how the process could lead to a socialist state or to the subordination of state and economic power to civil power. But in the symbiotic strategies that we're talking about, can it ever reach the point of subordination, or is it just increased social power up into the, but only to an extent that it's still subordinated to another?
But isn't if you're engaging in a symbiotic strategy, don't you have to be making the, it, by definition, isn't the state becoming more responsive to your interests as workers insofar as your strategy is succeeding?
And that leads kind of where I was going with my question, because I thought symbiotic strategies, if I remember from the old chapter that kind of did an introduction of them, it was they're more space specific, not actor specific, so that it talks about the spaces in which you work through these strategies and the institutions and all those things, but it doesn't talk necessarily about the actors. It says you work through the state, you know, of course we'll include elite actors by default, but it's not about class compromise and working with capitalists or elite classes. It's about working with the state or working with particular economic institutions or something. So I understood it as space-specific, not actor-specific. And then this whole chapter talks about compromising between, you know, these between classes or actors, and that it was completely different from what I had understood it before. And I think that gets to what you're saying and the limits of that, because as long as the issue of capitalist interests or having those compromises, I don't know, then you can't really get at the issue of increasing power. It's only through either, you know, through those groups themselves, through the state, through specific institutions in which you can increase power, but you're always going to come up to limits when you're working with capitalist class or elite classes. Or when you're not changing the institutions, you're trying to change the actors, and I don't.
Yes. Or even what you said in terms of making the state more responsive to the interests of the workers, is that the ultimate goal, or is the goal to be able to create conditions? I mean, it's still like saying that the state has the power to set the conditions, and that where I thought the whole point was to try and
work through the state and change the state,
or like for the or I guess a radical egalitarian democracy. I thought there was more power within the people to set their own condition. Or I don't know. Do you see what I'm saying? That it's not.
It depends on your theory of the state. So if you're assuming that you're working with a strongly capitalist state, you have to make the state subordinate to your interests. If you see the state, I think Eric is looking at the state as a field of contest, so that insofar as your symbiotic strategy is working and the state is becoming more responsive to your interests, the hue of the state becomes more colored towards the interests of workers insofar as you're succeeding.
Right.
One example, which is different from the examples I emphasized in the chapter, but which we've discussed, the participatory budget in Porto Alegre is a symbiotic strategy. It strengthens social power, and it solves a set of problems that make the city better for elites as well. Solves problems of how that city is managed, how its resources are used, which certainly the affluent sections of the middle class broadly supported. Arguably, it served capitalist interests as well. UNESCO, you know, said that Porto Alegre was a model city for the world for these reasons. So one view is to say, well, it must be undesirable because it's been supported by the world. The World Bank thinks it's great. The World Bank thinks Porto Alegre is a success story. Therefore, the participatory budget must be a bad idea, because if it serves the interests of financial elites represented by the World Bank, it can't be something that's also socially empowering. And that's one of the criticisms that ultra-leftists have made of Porto Alegre. They just feel that because of who some of the awards the city has gotten, it must be a suspect program. The alternative view is, no, this is a very successful paradigm for finding those situations where you can stably expand popular power in a way that has actually redirected city spending towards the poorest segments of the city. So on all the criteria that we would care about, it is more egalitarian and it is more democratic. And it creates neighborhood associations that are more politically engaged. And it's made ordinary citizens believe, at least when it was in its heyday, I mean, it's one of the difficulties for reasons other than its design, I think. But ordinary citizens gain experience in the business of deliberating and making compromises over priorities in the way that you have to do if you're going to have a functioning direct democracy. So I think it's a kind of perfect example of what I mean by a symbiotic strategy. And it would not have been successful if the result of its practices was to continually antagonize the most powerful interests in the city so that they would have all massively disinvested and unemployment would have tripled. You know, the fact that it solved problems meant that elites were at least ambivalent. You know, they at least felt, okay, it's not threatening us, which is true. It's not calling into question capitalism. So it is within these limits. But it's solving problems, so let's go along with it.
But doesn't that have to do with the goal also? For the goal for those people in those neighborhoods is to increase their own social power. But, I mean, in this chapter, so much of it was like, what can we do that will increase the, you know, conditions for capitalists or improve conditions for capitalists as well? So it also has to do with goals. Like, these people are participating, but, is it, you know, and maybe it did solve problems for capitalists, but that wasn't particularly the goal, was it?
Well, but it is a central feature of the strategy, if it's to be a strategy of stable. I mean, I'm illustrating a form of strategy that attempts to stably ratchet up the equilibrium level of social power in a configuration. So not just to have the flash in the pan victories where you, in periods of hypermobilization, you win victories, and then you burn out the social energy because you can't sustain that level forever. Mm-hmm. And then there's a counteroffensive and everything gets undone. You know, so the kind of episodic, intense left gains followed by demoralizing defeats and unraveling, that sort of strategy does not also seem like a good strategy for fundamental transformation. You have these moments of great hope and aspiration, but they always seem to crumble and disintegrate in their afterwards. So the idea, you know, like I actually agree with most of your skepticism about whether symbiotic strategies can transform the fundamental structures of the society, but not because I find there's some other strategy for which I'm not skeptical. Because we can make very good arguments for why all of these strategies can't possibly work. And, you know, those arguments might be right. But this is more, so the purpose of making these arguments is to give credibility to a kind of strategy and then to say it's a kind of empirical and historical question how far you can push these. We don't know. We don't know really what the limits are. And we don't know, we don't really have answers to the questions, which is what I feel is pretty much the fundamental question here. What can we do now, given the constraints under which we are now in, that might set the stage when historical conditions open up new possibilities for us to push forward in a more radical way? So maybe the answer is nothing. That's one possible answer. Or interstitial is another answer. Yeah.
I got a conceptual problem. I mean, another one. Can you give an actual example of a negative class compromise.
Negative class compromise?
Right, and why that wouldn't be symbiotic too. I mean, if just by making concessions between each other, they're kind of benefiting each other. So why wouldn't that be part of a...
Well, a negative class compromise is a group of workers go on strike, they cause damage to the firm, makes a cost-benefit analysis of how long they can hold out on the strike, and they strike a deal with the workers and say, okay, we'll give you this wage increase if you stop causing trouble. So it is a compromise. Workers don't get everything they want. Capitalists make some concessions. Capitalists don't get everything they want. But the condition for the compromise is merely their respective abilities to harm each other.
But the workers will continue working, so they will continue.
Right, that's their part of the their part of the concession is we will continue working.
And so, from one point of view, they will continue. I mean, in some way, benefiting the company or whatever.
Right. So,
so why wouldn't that be symbiotic? I mean, it's not we're gonna get the owners of this firm out of the way and we're gonna take over. It's not like we're going to jeopardize the production by doing this interstitial strategy of...
So the difference is that in the balance of forces compromise, as soon as anything that makes workers weaker will lead to a rollback in those concessions. There's no stable reason why capitalists will continue this concessions if workers are weakened for some reason. Whereas in a positive class compromise, there is. And capitalists will not engage in a counteroffensive against workers whenever the conditions would make it possible, because it's actually not to capitalist advantage to weaken workers, unless they can do so, tremendously. I mean, if you remember the way those curves are drawn, if capitalists in Sweden could completely dismantle the labor movement and have an American-style atomized labor market. Well, it's possible that they would opt for that if they could snap their fingers and get it, but they can't. And they're constrained by the institutionalized forms of collective power of workers that block them from having that kind of counteroffensive. Given that, the system works better when workers are pretty well organized rather than less organized. So the positive class compromise has this stabler equilibrium because it doesn't just depend upon the ability to impose damage on each other. I mean, that's the idea of it in any case. So negative class compromises occur all the time. Indeed, one can argue that even in the absence of collective action, there's a negative class compromise. Capitalists have a problem of eliciting cooperation from workers. They need some levels of consent from the active consent from the labor force, unless they're in very simple kinds of labor processes where a purely despotic form of control works well. And if they're not in that kind of situation where a purely despotic form works well, then they have to work out some kind of deal with their workers. But that's because of the ability of individual workers to impose harms on capitalists, namely by withholding full cooperation.
So if it's the... Because I also see that probably the most common way that people try to change whatever condition they're in, even at a high level or low level, is through this sort of negative class compromise. So in terms of a strategy, why not... Where would that fit? Or is it just kind of isolated action that eventually should take one of these three courses? What were you envisioning that?
I'm not opposed to negative class compromises. I just think positive class compromises are better for popular social forces than negative ones. That is, positive class compromises have greater capacity to be deeply institutionalized in the rules of the system, and therefore to constitute a more stable shift in the hybrid towards one with a stronger socialist component than negative class compromises. So I'm all in favor of negative class compromises. That's just ordinary fighting the ruling class and making the gains you can by virtue of your collective power. I have no objection.
And if you have the collective power to make huge gains, then fantastic. But you're saying in the absence of that, we have right? Positive class compromise. It seems like the key for it is really the ability to institutionalize change under conditions in which negative class compromise with significant gains for workers is limited, right?
Well, positive class compromise requires more power on the part of the working class than negative class compromise. It's easier. A smaller group of workers can then cause disruption, then can provide coherence to the new equilibrium. That requires more solidarity. So it's harder to achieve a positive class compromise. And in order to stabilize it, you usually, I think, have to also think about changing the rules of the game. That is, you know, in that model, there are these institutional exclusions. That's where you have, where you create things like labor law, which make it easy or difficult to organize. So to consolidate a positive class compromise, really you do need these protections that make it harder for capital to engage in counteroffenses when it wants to.
Yeah. When you were talking about Porto Alegre, I have a question. Maybe it's in the chapter and now I miss it. How do you measure actually that it's a positive outcome for capitalist class? Because maybe the World Bank would see Porto Alegre as positive, but actually it's not for the interest of the financial. I mean, how do you take that as well? What they think is positive, then?
Well, I do take the endorsement of the World Bank as at least a rough indicator that it's good for capitalism.
Yeah, well, they were wrong many times. that's what I'm saying. The FMI and the World Bank were wrong about what would be better for.
You're right. So they could be wrong.
Yes, but in more theoretical terms,
you can count them to be wrong on what's good for workers. They're probably more reliable on knowing what's good for capitalists.
But I would think that in that case, what was good for capitalists was all of a sudden these things that caused tremendous amounts of tension among the working class were alleviated. And that was good for capitalists, because then it's no longer the problem. Like, at the minimum, that would, I think, would be what they win, which could be quite substantial.
It's, and what's been argued about, I don't know how to measure these things accurately, you know, in terms of an index of
the World Bank reports.
But the kinds of things that have been said is that Porto Alegre is a city within which there's much more predictability about a whole range of issues. Corruption is very low. You don't have to engage in bribes to get permits to invest, to start new businesses, to do whatever. You know, it's a much more orderly city than it was prior to the participatory budget, in a way that creates, in those terms, a good business climate. In other respects, Porto Alegre is more hostile to capital, clearly. Apparently, when there was a big investment project of Ford Motor Company to build a plant somewhere in Brazil, and various cities were competing with each other for tax breaks, and Ford was initially very interested in having the factory in Porto Alegre, because of the participatory budget, basically, they couldn't get the tax breaks, as the city was hostile to making that degree of concession and withdrew from the race to the bottom, the tax competition for that major investment. Now, that the ability of a city to do that is unusual. I mean, cities usually buy into the view that a very substantial tax subsidy to those kinds of investments is worthwhile because of the jobs and, you know, spillover effects. But in Porto Alegre, they partially decided that the payoff from that wasn't as big as it's always claimed to be, and also that they didn't want to engage in an accumulation strategy that had that character. So that's a kind of anti-capitalist element, but on the other hand, they could only really do that because they had created a favorable environment for local investment. It was a good place for capitalists that were rooted there to invest. And so I think that's what made them a little bit more autonomous from global capital and the threats of it, because they had created a local environment where at least the capitalist environment was good enough.
So it's not a social, psychological measure, right? They feel good, so this is a positive compromise. It's more like a material.
A good happiness.
Yeah, there is.
Well, I mean, it would be awfully nice if we could figure out a way of linking together how happy capitalists felt with increasing social power, not how much it served their actual interests.
Okay,
that would be the ideal policy. The ideal policy would be one in which
antidepressant subscriptions.
You know, we create profound illusions on the part of the capitalist class so that they are seduced into benevolence. I mean, to get back to Todd's original two-sided question, I think the easier side is the so one version of the question is, if you have successful symbiotic strategies that really and robustly work, that will create a privileged enclave. Those who are able to participate in that symbiotic strategy will do better than those who are not. And if we think of that globally, then that's a kind of, it increases the global divide. That's different from the other form of the question, which is whether it also depends upon those global inequalities. Let's bracket that for a moment. Does this strengthen them, make them worse? I think the argument against that view is that the kind of egalitarian and social empowerment processes involved in symbiotic transformations, I think, empirically make countries and polities that are involved in that more likely to be attentive to global inequalities rather than less. Empirically, the countries which contribute most to global development funds are the ones that are the most internally egalitarian and social democratic in this way. So social democracy within countries, if anything, probably contributes to global equality rather than to deepening global inequality. Now, that could be true even if it was still the case that they depended upon global inequality. But I don't think the argument that internal redistribution and empowering workers depends upon a global redistribution to those places is very plausible. Because these mechanisms don't depend upon the a place having huge amounts of surplus to redistribute. It's not primarily a question of redistributing surplus to workers to improve their standards of living. Symbiotic strategies are primarily about increasing forms of solving collective action problems and making and solving problems as a result. So Porto Alegre, it's probably the case that Porto Alegre was able to do this because it wasn't the poorest and most devastated part of Brazil. But, so it is one of the more affluent parts of Brazil, but I don't think Porto Alegre's ability to do this depended upon there also being Recife. You know, it wasn't because of the uneven development in Brazil and the transfers of surplus from the poorest parts of Brazil to the wealthiest that enabled Porto Alegre to forge a symbiotic compromise.
No, I wouldn't say that about Porto Alegre, but I'm thinking again more of...
Oh.
It's like, Molly wants more wine?
but they haven't had a chance to talk yet.
Yeah, that's why they just won't talk yet.
Well, is that because it turns off after an hour?
I think so, yeah.
It seems like it. It's been
Hi,
a few
we're
weeks.
Back. Let's give them a... Do you guys want to say anything about this conversation we're having?
Maybe I do.
Anyone from...
No, I think we are okay. No, we have no question. But I have one question.
I was shocked. Okay.
Who's that? That's Rodrigo.
Yeah, we look at each one of them because we never really actually get to see
them. Yeah, do them close up so we can see them.
So you.
Okay, Rodrigo.
Sí. Well, the question refers to the positive class compromise. In some political ideals or values, this is closely like a notion of class harmony or class conciliation. For example, in Argentina, this positive class compromise is very closely to some values of the Peronism. So what is the link between this positive class compromise and the class struggle, the notion of class struggle? And the second is if this positive class compromise implies some kind of strong association of workers. But if it is in that way, why to be positive in terms of compromise if you have strong in association?
The concept of positive class compromise that I'm trying to elaborate is not the same as a notion of class harmony. It does not imply that there is a dissolving of antagonistic interests between workers and capitalists, and that they become, in some sense, relations of reciprocity and mutual support. So it's not at all based on an image of class harmony. The presupposition of positive class compromise is that the stability of the forms of cooperation which it involved depend upon the power of workers. And the power of workers includes their ability to impose constraints on capitalists, which capitalists don't like, and thus involves the exercise of real power. That's why those zones of exclusion are so important. If those zones of exclusion that I map out on that chart were not created, then even if you have a positive class compromise, whenever workers would become weak, they could, counteroffenses could push them back towards the low power part of the curve. So the idea is that through class struggle, rules are created and constraints imposed on capital, which create then a strategically accessible part of this curve, within which, given that capitalists are forced to stay on that part of the curve, they can't escape it, and given that workers cannot go beyond it, so workers are also constrained. It's only part of this curve which is available. Under those conditions, then, workers and capitalists can find ways of cooperating, which is better for both of them than under those conditions to just perpetually fight each other and to only win concessions as opposed to solve problems. So the problem-solving capacity of the system goes up, which is beneficial to both workers and capitalists, given the balance of power which defines the part of the curve in which you're located. So that's why it's not a class harmony view. It's a stable institutionalized equilibrium of class struggle, which then can be called a positive class compromise when it's in those, under those conditions. What was the second, I forget what the second part of your question.
Are you a Peronist?
No, I don't think this is fair.
That's the line.
I forget what the second part of the... That's the class harmony part.
The second part was if this positive class compromise implies a strong associational power of the workers, or because I think in this positive class compromise more when the class isn't organized so well, like an instrument to get an worker associational power, not as a action or a strategy when the this power is strong, but I'm asking you.
No, the concept I'm trying to develop here does imply strong working class power. And the question is, what do workers do with the power they have when they're very well organized and have strong, robust associations? What do they do? What do they try to accomplish beyond just the immediate goals of providing jobs and wages and other forms of security? One thing they could do is try to overthrow capitalism. Well, we know that's, you need a lot more power than historically is available to working class associations to actually overthrow capitalism. So if you have a strong working class association, you can't overthrow capitalism. You have strong unions, you have strong working class parties, a social democratic party that can win elections, but you can't overthrow capitalism. You're not that powerful. What do you do? What are the strategies available to you? Well, symbiotic strategies are one of the possibilities. I'm not arguing that it's the only possibility, but what I am arguing is that to the extent you can find ways of engaging in symbiotic strategies and use your power for those purposes, you're more likely to be able to institutionalize the hybrid configuration of capitalist, socialist, and statist power relations to reinstitutionalize it or reconstruct it in a way in which the social power component gets deepened and broadened. And therefore, capitalism becomes less capitalistic. Now, that implies that you agree with this hybridization idea. You know, not everybody thinks that's a sensible way of talking about capitalism and socialism. Many people still basically believe that these are binary concepts, and that if they're binary concepts, there's not much you can do inside of capitalism to move it in a socialist direction. Because as soon as you would entertain that possibility, you've got a hybrid concept. So if you have a real binary concept, then these symbiotic things look like just a particular way of getting concessions and benefits for workers, rather than a way of changing the power relations in the institutional configuration. I'm arguing that it's a way of changing power relations, but I don't know what the limits are. You know, I wish I had a better theory of, you know, limits, and certainly I wish I had a theory of trajectories. I mean, as I've said, the absence of a theory of what the underlying trajectory of the system is like hampers all of these strategic discussions. But I don't have such a theory, and I don't know how to produce one. And so, in the absence of that, this is the kind of way I would approach then thinking about the use of associational power under those conditions when you're able to create new institutions with it. Rodolfo
is in charge in case.
And, you know, you're Rodolfo's assistant?
Yeah.
So,
keep training.
Yeah. Okay.
Rodolfo has to go.
Yeah.
Hey?
Yeah.
Yes, I also have a question.
Okay, is this Pablo?
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
Well, I understood the class compromise as a means to reach a long-term goal, the construction of the democratic, radical democratic egalitarian society. But this strategy does not challenge the mechanisms of exploitation and domination. And I think that this strategy could be combined with other strategies. What do you think about this? Because I think that in some historic periods, this strategy could retreat a revolutionary process.
I certainly think that all of these strategies and other, you know, I've made a distinction among three types of strategy: ruptural, interstitial, and symbiotic. Perhaps there are others. And you know, in my notes, in response, I think to Ricardo's comment, that stimulated me to slightly re-describe the distinctions between these three strategies a little bit. So there may be more. My own view is, of course, that these would have to be combined. If we really tried to imagine a strategy for the transformation of the whole system, a system transformation strategy would have to combine these different particular strategies in different ways. Nevertheless, I do want to argue that each of these strategies is strategies which have as their fundamental goal the transformation of the overall structure of the system, including symbiotic strategies. That is, symbiotic strategies have as their goal increasing social power within the hybrid to the point where, eventually, through an unspecified final process, social power could become the dominant power within the configuration. Just as was the case for interstitial strategies. Interstitial strategies imagine you could build new forms of social power, new institutions, you could expand co-ops, you could build workers' libraries in Cordoba, popular libraries in Cordoba, you could do Wikipedia, you could do all these interstitial activities which would constitute an interstitial strategy because they occupy more and more space within the society, they embody more and more social labor within them, and they end up organizing enough of the economy that there would be a phase shift, and what we thought was capitalist, we'd wake up on a Thursday morning and discover, so to speak, that the capitalist primacy had been eroded. Well, I think that's a fantasy. I'm not saying that's a coherent view, a coherent strategy, because there's too many unspecified processes. But all of these strategies have as their vision increasing social power to the point where ultimately social power becomes the dominant principle of organization within an economy, and thus a democratic egalitarian normative structure can become the primary normative basis for organizing economic activity. So I think that's the idea behind symbiotic as well as the other two. I don't think we're really in a position to say definitively, yes, we know now that symbiotic strategies under no historical conditions are going to be able to accumulate sufficient social power within a capitalist system that they would be unable to push beyond the limit of subordination within capitalism. You know, I don't think we know that. I don't know what theoretical arguments would be sufficient to make us confident that that was true. I happen to think that there probably are such limits. I mean, that's my guess, my intuition, but I can't prove that. You know, I can't give you a deductive argument based on evidence and argument of the underlying dynamics and mechanisms which would make that convincing.
What would be those limits?
Well, that somehow we know now that the nature of capitalism is such that as social power increases to the point where it could conceivably threaten the basic dominance of capitalism,
There's some retrenchment?
There'd be some mechanism that would counteract it, which could either be an instrumental mechanism, that is, capitalists, the people, would rise up against the symbiotic reforms, the symbiotic mechanisms, and roll them back, regardless of the costs, so that capitalists would be prepared to make big sacrifices in the short run in order to restore a more favorable balance of power. Well, I kind of suspect that that's what would happen. You know, history shows capitalists are prepared to mobilize very sharp and destructive forces to prevent change. But of course, that's occurred under earlier technological and historical and global conditions, not the future ones. And that's when I say I don't know what the limits are. It's because I don't believe we can simply extrapolate from past experience and assume that those past experiences give us an adequate guide to what future conditions would be like. But my general, this is a long-winded answer to your question. I'm sorry to go on and on as much. But so I do think these have to be combined. That symbiotic strategies and interstitial strategies, at this particular moment in history, I think those are the two kinds of processes which we can imagine can complement each other and reinforce each other. Symbiotic strategies can open up new spaces for interstitial strategies, for example, and interstitial strategies can help build communities that are then capable of more symbiotic collective action. So I think that those two kinds of strategic possibilities encompass a lot of things that we can do in the here and now. And how these get connected to ruptural strategies or more confrontational strategies is another, you know, another issue. Does that sort of answer the, whether I've satisfied you, but does it answer, engage the question?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
I assume everybody at your end who is going to be here today is there now, right? Has everybody arrived who's going?
Could you repeat?
before you all arrived, we did some housekeeping to arrange the plans. And I just want to go over them, since this is the last collective meeting before we welcome you in our arms in Wisconsin. I just want to go through to tell each of you who is going to be your host and pick you up and just confirm a couple of details. Maria Anna, so you're being picked, we discussed with you, you're being picked up by Kathy, and Kathy will be your host in Madison.
Yes.
And
what did they say? I feel all self-conscious.
So I want to check the nights that you'll be staying in Madison. I know some people are going to Chicago afterwards. So what I have on my list for Kathy is you arrive on the 8th. I mean, for Mariana, you arrive on the 8th. And so
on the 8th.
So it's 8th. And then the conference is the 9th and the 10th, Sunday the 11th, and Monday the 12th. So you leave on the 13th, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Santiago, are you is Santiago there?
No, he's sick.
No, he's not here.
Oh, okay. Okay, so Santiago, and Julian, you're here, right? Yes.
Yeah, are you here?
Okay. So what day do you leave? You arrive on the 8th, right?
Yeah.
What day do you leave?
What time?
Wednesday.
On Monday.
You leave on Monday the 12th.
On Monday or Tuesday?
So we'll put you. You'll be staying with Guillaume. There's Guillaume. He'll be staying.
We don't see him. Wait, does he know what time?
Oh,
we don't see him.
Move the camera to.
Oh.
Where is
he? There's Guillaume. Can you see Guillaume now? Okay.
For the cut, you
know. Oh, they're laughing because they couldn't see you.
Okay, so Julian, you'll stay with Guillaume on the 8th, the 11th, and the 12th. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. And Roxana.
Yes.
What day do you, we have you arriving on the 6th, and
yes.
you'll be staying with Charity.
Okay.
And you leave on what day?
I'm not sure.
Monday or Tuesday. Okay. We'll put you down for Monday or Tuesday. Rodrigo.
Yes.
You are also going to stay with Guillaume.
Okay.
Guillaume from Quebec. He's one of our two Canadians.
In Canadian.
I suppose I will stay with Rodolfo, but I don't know.
Well, Rodolfo said that he would pick you up, but Rodolfo...
He has two already.
Rodolfo had Pablo and Santiago staying with him.
Okay.
In terms of how much room he has.
That was Pablo.
What?
That was Pablo.
Was I just talking to Pablo? I thought it was Rodrigo I was talking to. Rodrigo. Rodolfo said you were going to go to Chicago after the conference. Is that right?
Yes, Monday or Tuesday.
But
Juliana, I think with Roxana in Santiago.
We won't know Chicago.
Okay, but here is the question. Your flight back to Buenos Aires leaves from Madison, not Chicago.
Yes.
Once you're here, you could try to see if you could cancel the Madison-Chicago part, because you'll be in Chicago. It'd be better to get the airplane there. But I think you'll have to come back to Madison.
Yes.
So,
maybe we have to come back to Madison, yes.
And so the question is, do you think you'll be staying in Madison the night before you fly back to Argentina?
I don't think, because I think, no, because the flight leaves from Madison in the morning, and I think we can travel at night, came in the morning to the Madison, take the flight.
Well, we'll discuss this when you come. We don't have to plan this now, but you should know that if you want to come back and stay here the night before, people said that it's fine for you to stay at their house again that the night before your flight. Ricardo, is Ricardo there?
I'm not sure because I'm not.
He has a problem in his shop.
Okay. Okay, so I think everybody else then is taken care of. Okay.
Yes.
We
tell him.
Do we know what time? I'm supposed to pick up Julian. I don't know what time
he's getting in. Julian, do you know what time your flight arrives in Madison?
In the morning, 7 or 8.
Okay. we'll actually, I think Rodolfo has all the flight schedules, so we'll get it, the detail.
From the 8th, yeah.
No, it's okay.
And also, if this is real combat duty, I can. I'm not really. All right, okay.
Here's your commitment to the cause.
No. Okay, let's get back to business. Tonight again, like the last couple of times, Michael Burovoy is giving his last lecture tonight. So we'll stop in about 20 minutes for his lecture this evening. So I think rather than take a break, we should just continue on. Okay, well, that was, we spent a fair amount of time on we, of course, traveled through many of these issues.
Before we go on to...
Yes.
Can we go through some of the what's going to happen on that weekend, like the presentation?
Okay, let me, Eduardo wanted me to say something about how the weekend will be organized. How the how we'll actually do the weekend. So, and I will also write a memo, which I'll send around to everybody with an actual schedule. We will go to this conference site, which is about an hour north of Madison, on a beautiful river. You'll like it very much. It's very pleasant place. We'll arrive there between 5:30 and 6 on Friday afternoon. And for Friday evening, we'll order pizza from a local pizza place for dinner, rather than have dinner at the conference center. We will have a program. The opening session of the conference will be Friday evening. I felt it was a good idea for us to start Friday evening so that each of the sessions we have can be pretty relaxed. There's going to be a total of around 15 or 16 presentations. I don't have an exact count. There are three people coming from California who were part of a seminar I gave there who will be presenting papers, and a group from Minnesota that is going to run one session. So I don't have an exact count of actual papers, but it'll be somewhere around 16. What I'd like to do for the conference then is to have each presentation will have about a half hour, possibly 35 minutes allocated for each person, which will be divided between presenting the paper and having discussion. Ideally, people's presentations will be in the 15 to 20 minute range, and then we'll have about 15 minutes of discussion for each paper in general. I will organize those semi-thematically once I get all the titles and abstracts from everyone. So I'll prepare a program where I'll group things together. So, for example, one of the people from Berkeley is doing something on the Misiones in Venezuela, and Sherrod is working on urban land reform and various things connected to that. And we will put those together just as a pair. So we'll have a series of sessions, each lasting about, roughly 2 hours or so, 2 hours and 15 minutes with breaks in between. Friday night, one or possibly two on Saturday morning. It depends upon how early we actually think we will get going. Early afternoon, the first part of the afternoon on Saturday after lunch, the conference center is making canoes available to us, so we'll have a couple of hours of canoeing on the river for those who would like to. It's a very nice river to canoe on, and because we had so much snow this winter, there's going to be a lot of water in the river. It should be fairly interesting canoeing on the river.
What's the water temperature?
Warm.
The water temperature is It won't be. It's not like a glacial pond, you know. It's
but close.
It'll be brisk.
It'll be cold when I tip you over, you know.
Then we'll have a another session late afternoon on Saturday. Saturday evening we're going to have a party where I want everyone who plays a musical instrument to bring their instruments. There's a couple of the people from Minneapolis play instruments. Todd plays guitar. I play fiddle. We'll bring a bunch of drums.
My stomach drums.
Yeah, you can. And we'll have a party, and then at around, just so you, if you really want to know the details, around 10 o'clock or 10:30, those who are interested will walk up the road about a kilometer to a country bar that has karaoke.
And if you're really lucky, you'll get to see Eric sing songs from The Wizard of Oz.
So it has karaoke and pool. So we'll go to the karaoke bar and play pool for a while. And then on Sunday morning, we'll continue workshops on Sunday morning and Sunday afternoon. And sometime in the middle or end of Sunday afternoon, just depending upon how long everything takes. I want the rhythm of this to be relaxed and not feeling that we, you know, have to keep moving on to the next thing, even if we're not done with the discussion. And that means we'll have to have a little bit of flexibility. That's why I have asked people to think of it as all Sunday rather than ending at right after lunch on Sunday. Okay?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Okay. Any questions from you guys about the conference or?
So we are staying in that of from good.
Yeah.
The 9th, the 10th, and the 11th.
Well, not the night of the 11th. We'll go back to Madison, you know, late afternoon, early evening, 5 or 6, something like that, on Sunday.
And we were wondering about what clothes to take.
Okay, so
about the weather and
the weather, the warm, the highs for the day should be somewhere between 10 and 20 degrees Celsius.
Big range.
Somewhere in that range.
It's, you know, just like
5 and 12?
10 and 20.
10 and 20.
10 and 20. You know, roughly. It could be in the day. I mean, that's saying that in the day it'll be between 15 and 70. Yeah. And that's about what it'll be.
Yeah, that is.
So in the daytime it'll be between 10 and 20.
15 and 70 is bigger than 10 to 20.
And at night it'll be between
34, 40.
3 or 4 degrees and 8 or 9 degrees at night. It's about a 30% chance that it'll be rainy, but probably most likely we'll have nice weather.
Okay.
It has happened in the history of Wisconsin. It has happened that there's been snow in early May. But I don't think that's going to happen.
So, Eric, you realize you just described winter in Buenos Aires.
Yes, it actually, the weather might not be all that different between Buenos Aires in early May and Madison in early May, right? 10 degrees, 10 or 15 degrees is what you'd expect in Buenos Aires?
In August.
In May?
Yeah.
And you don't have to. As you can see by looking at us, it'll be completely informal in terms of what you wear. You don't have to. For our sakes, you don't have to bring any fancy clothing.
That's what you're saying.
Speak for yourself.
No, I am sorry. I just insulted my colleagues here.
Do we need to bring towels, bedding?
Oh,
bed,
no.
Anything like that?
No.
Yeah.
The
shampoo, conditioner.
We want to be showering.
They do have good shower. They have good showers, so you can. The conference center where we're staying has two kinds of sleeping facilities. They have rustic cabins. The rustic cabins, you have to bring sleeping bags and stuff. And they have what they call dormitories, which are four beds to a room. And I reserved the dormitories. Because I thought of organizing all the sleeping bags for people coming from Argentina would be more trouble than it's worth. The rustic cabins are actually very cool because they're on a bluff up in the woods.
Be open if we want to?
You can just sleep outside if you wish.
That's true, I can.
I didn't reserve them.
It'll be for the rest of the summer.
Any other questions?
That means that we don't have to take towels and...
Right.
No, we think we are fine.
Okay, good. You don't have to bring... they do have towels. The towels they have are, you know...
Rustic.
They're smallish. They're not especially... If you like a big bath towel...
Will they cover you?
Do we get robes?
No.
With your name on it?
Thinking about linens, or are you cold at night? Bring an extra blanket, because there's plastic... I mean, they're camp beds. So they're made for kids. They're everything's plastic. Pillows are plastic. Everything's
flat. Right. Well, you were there last in December, so it was a little...
That's true, I was cold.
It was a little colder. This won't be quite as demanding.
So.
Okay. Well, we've whittled away at our time. We have time for another theme. If somebody wants to bring up some novel theme...
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
Someone had to. Did you want to go?
No, just.
I'm very. There's like a lot of focus in this book on overthrowing the power of capital, and you responded to this, and I guess I used sort of the wrong words, but it's a lot of focus on like capital and the ways to destabilize it, and then the ways to sort of manage a society without it, and I think that. Whereas in our current, the way we currently live, capital is what plays a really big role in determining our lives. It's also just the form that power has taken now, is its manifestation through capital. And I think just sort of globally, a lot more attention needs to be put on like how do you make alternatives that don't allow other forms of privilege to take place, and how do you constantly learn to be able to adapt to. Because I think a lot of innovations that have happened, institutional innovations that have been happened for really good reasons and in very pro-democratic ways, and then have not lasted because other forms of privilege have come back up, or they don't have the built-in capacity to continue to learn. And I think that that's a really big challenge that. And I just think so many utopic designs, like so many really amazing designs we've had in the past, have ended up being the things we really dislike right now for that reason. Because they haven't been able to.
But is that because of what might be called some endogenous process of corruption of the original design, or is it because these egalitarian alternatives have been created inside of a capitalist environment so that they're corroded or transformed because of the pressures from the outside in which they operate. Because one's diagnosis of which of those or how those two play off of each other matters a lot for what lessons you learn from it. A good example, I think, is what the fate of the kibbutzim in Israel was. Now, you know, there's lots of problems in the debates and discussions about the kibbutz because of the particular colonialist context of Israel. I think we can... I would like to bracket that problem. Not that it's not a
bracketable.
I don't mean that it's not a fundamentally important problem, but the kibbutz was the most radical egalitarian democratic design for a community that we've seen in the 20th century, for sure. And it lasted for two and a half generations in its original form. So it had staying power.
Yeah. But it's, well,
you know, it lasted, and it had a level of radicalism in its egalitarian principles that is unmatched. And there is this debate as to whether what undid it, because basically they still exist, but they no longer have these very deep and sort of profoundly egalitarian principles in play. So there's an issue as to whether what made them ultimately unsustainable was that they were islands of democratic equality in this sea of market and capitalist relations, or whether it was some flaw in the internal design and logic of such an extreme form of radical equality.
But I don't know if we want to get into kibbutzim, but they weren't exactly islands in they weren't substantially interstitial. The way the national government of Israel was set up was very heavily leaning towards a socialist-oriented labor government, and the way in which Israel, for instance, had, for as long as there were kibbutzim in their heyday, had a single union called the establishment, which was an umbrella for every every organized labor. If they wanted to, they had something like 80 or 90% of the workforce organized under a single centralized organization. And that organization had very close ties to the kibbutzim. So they had a significant amount of social power as well. They could shut down the country.
Well, in that period, they worked fine. But
yeah, and they worked, yes, and they worked very closely with the state as well. So all the building, all construction, road construction, all major capital projects were nationalized, more or less. And I think it was something exogenous that...
Yeah, so one argument is that when that larger economic ecology of statist, socialist surround began to disintegrate in the 1980s, basically, maybe a little bit before, but it accelerated in the 80s, that's what then undercut the conditions for the reproduction of the kibbutz structure itself. As opposed to, though, privilege rearing its ugly head because of some internal...
But then my only experience with kibbutzism is through reading Golda Meir's autobiography.
Bad.
And she didn't have a very positive... Yeah. Well, I mean, she talked a lot about feminist struggles and difficulty of being able to, you know, not be the one who's always in charge of a kid just because she's a woman. Which undermined things. And which also... how should I say? You can understand that perhaps at the time when kibbutzism started, it was normal for women to take care of kids. But that changes. And so as that changes, expectations change. And the necessity of the structure that you're working in to be able to accommodate for radical change. I think radical change always has to be a part of society, because I don't think we're ever going to find that solution. So how do you accommodate the potential for radical change even within new institutions? It's sort of a second.
And one of my concerns is, so how exclusive is it just by design too? Because if it's only certain groups who are participating, it's not going to have that spread. You know, we don't see places here trying, as far as I know, trying to build a build something based on the model of the kibbutz that I know of.
I mean, I think 60s
and 70s. They're obviously not viable.
And they still exist.
They do.
But they existed. And I think that's one of the major issues I have with interstitial and symbiotic transformations, is if they are not inclusive by design, if they're not inclusive from the beginning, will they ever really be answers to solving the majority of society's problems, or including and building popular power for the majority rather than these elite groups, or
you know, building a new labor elite or whatever. And also, you know, we've been thinking a lot in the last couple of weeks with Burboy being here about, you know, the role of the elite or the role of the academic, and if it's just people in those groups carrying out these changes on a wide scale, you know, we'll have the same kind of problems.
If the design of a interstitial institution, that is, you build a co-op, is something that can be replicated by anybody who shares the goals and values, then even though the members of any particular co-op are limited and therefore necessarily exclusionary, that is, any co-op is going to have a limit to how big it can grow, how many members it can add, without it then running into organizational problems, which would undermine it. You know, that scale could be very big or very small, but there are limits. So they necessarily have a boundary condition. But I don't think it's a reasonable criticism of them to say that they're elitist if it isn't a property of them that you have to be in an elite in order to do it. Even if it's the case that it's educated, committed people who decides to do it. If what they're creating is a model that, in fact, with modest resources, people could do, and then the task of expanding it and making it something accessible becomes one of creating the institutional surround, which, for example, for the co-op case, helps solve the credit problem, which is a huge one. Or the or the network problem, that is, co-ops work best when they're embedded in networks of co-ops rather than isolated ones. And to create that network requires something other than a co-op. It may require facilitating organizations. So I don't think the fact that elites, particularly intellectual elites, may be heavily involved in creating experiments necessarily implies that the experiments themselves are elitist. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the ways in which interstitial and symbiotic things can complement each other, because symbiotic transformations have the potential to operate more at the centers of power, to involve these kind of compromises where new rules and new resources become made available to help solve broader arrays of problems, but in which then the solution can be these more socially empowered interstitial kinds of initiatives rather than either capitalist initiatives or state-directed initiatives.
Isn't the case of the kibbutz sort of precisely the example that points to the importance of ideology in sustaining these kinds of things of the long run, in the sense that, I mean, and I don't know much about the case, but it just seems like you would think that what makes it a kind of a sustainable sort of period that it was is the sort of combination of settler colonialism with, you know, a particular kind of ethnic nationalism that gave people the sort of sense of solidarity and the desire to remain living in the kibbutz, right? And then so it's, and that sort of sense of perennial crisis that, you know, existed in the first couple of decades of Israel, right? And then it's sort of, my vision is after 1967 that is when it starts to become a less viable sort of model. So it just seems like people's sense of solidarity and their wanting to be in that particular kind of institution is absolutely critical to understanding how it worked. It's not simply an organizational form, it's something that...
Right, but so, I mean, I agree that you certainly need solidarity. Solidarity would hardly be enough to make this institution work. You know, it was designed in a particularly imaginative and creative way, and was really extreme in its egalitarianism, in a way that goes way beyond most solidaristic associations. So it was, I don't think you can derive the kibbutzim just from the solidarity and nationalism, even though that might have been the impetus for creating such communities. Furthermore, the most radical ones were exceptional. They were a limited subset of the full gambit. And the more radical ones worked extremely well as organizations, as associations of organizing community and production and family. So they did work extremely well, and then eventually imploded.
It's one thing to say that ideology isn't enough, and another thing to say that organizational viability isn't enough either. It seems like, I mean, again, I don't really have the historical basis, but it just seems like it was when one explanation for the demise is that is because of the demise of the ideology rather than anything else, right? And so it was when you lost the ideology that you lost the viability of the organizational form. So it's not that ideology is enough. Right, you had to have some sort of institutional framework that would make that viable in and of itself. But by the same token, the institutional design wasn't enough either. I mean, that would be an argument. I don't know if it's true. But
the other kind of argument for why this unraveled was they were so successful in cultivating highly educated, highly skilled people who had huge opportunities outside of the kibbutz, and because of the level of creativity and training that they received, and the kibbutz couldn't provide employment suitable to their talents, given how cultivated their talents became by virtue of the egalitarianism of the kibbutz. So that, you know, that proportionate to their population, the kibbutz produced more doctors and engineers and musicians and artists and professors. You know, lots of professors came out of the kibbutzim. So what happened is they got employment outside of the kibbutz and then returned to the kibbutzim. They still lived there, but then they worked at, you know, Hebrew University or whatever. And some still do. And for a long time, their entire salary just went to the kibbutz. That is, they were paid their own salary by the university, but they handed 100% of it over. And like everybody else, they had an allowance from the common pool. So people worked outside, got salaries, but all of their salary, 100% taxation on their salaries for the going into the common pool. And then everybody got an egalitarian allowance and took clothing from the clothing, not store, but building, because everything was free, internal to the kibbutz. And that actually lasted, that lasted for a generation. That was from the sort of mid-50s to the late 70s, was sort of that situation with employment from the outside. But the argument is that's what, the fact that some people could get so much money from the outside and then handing it over to the collective, there was a partial privatization of incomes is what wasn't the first move. It was one of the key moves for eroding the egalitarianism. But, and this is a complicated story. We're going to have, as part of the Real Utopias project, we're going to have a visitor next fall who's a sort of lefty Israeli professor of, he's a social psychologist, but
who?
Uri Levitan.
Uh-huh.
He's going to come and talk about the kibbutz. Huh. Do you know him?
Yeah.
I don't know him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He and his kibbutz voted against eliminating the pooling of salaries. He was one of the last holdouts. He gave his entire professorial salary to the kibbutz. Mm-hmm. Thought that should maintain the rules. If you didn't like that, you should leave, as opposed to...
He's a social psychologist?
Yeah. Well, it's a quarter... We strayed a little bit from symbiotic transformations, but I think we need to wrap up here so we can get to Michael Burvoy's lecture. We will see you in 3 weeks, everybody.
Okay.
Have a safe flight, and we're looking forward to meeting you in person, all of you.
Well, we would like to thank everybody there, and it was a very nice experience for us.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.